I think it's always important to source your materials, and that's exactly what I did.
An Anchorage Assembly member defends herself for saying a Valley man may be stockpiling weapons as part of an Islamic revolt. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, December 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, inside a safe within a safe, the results of the only test well ever drilled in Anwar.
It's sort of like a murder mystery, you know, a paperback book.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
President-elect Donald Trump has selected a friend of the oil and gas industry to be EPA administrator, Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt. Pruitt has fought President Obama's environmental policies on behalf of his state and with other attorneys general. He was a leader in a multi-state lawsuit against the EPA over its Clean Power Plan, designed to reduce emissions from power plants. U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan says the choice shows Trump is committed to trimming EPA's, quote, lawless overreach. Environmental groups say Pruitt would be a fox guarding the hen house. Tiernan Sittenfeld at the League of Conservation Voters says Pruitt's multiple lawsuits against the EPA show Pruitt opposes the agency's mission.
Scott Pruitt is an incredibly damaging and really a horrific choice to lead an agency that's charged with protecting public health and the environment. And we will do everything we can to stop him from getting anywhere close to the EPA.
Pruitt's Oklahoma State bio describes him as a leading advocate against the EPA's activist agenda. Jeff Holmstead advises energy companies at the government affairs firm Bracewell. He says Pruitt will be good for the petroleum industry.
We really have had, especially in the last few years, kind of federal government hostility to any kind of fossil fuel development. And President-elect Trump and now his EPA administrator just don't believe that that is consistent with U.S. interest.
Holmstead, an EPA official in the Bush administration, says one way Pruitt is likely to help industry is by ditching the EPA's proposed methane rule. Proponents say the rule would reduce dangerous greenhouse gas emissions by requiring companies to stop methane leaks from oil and gas wells. Holmstead says complying with the rule would be expensive, making some fields uneconomic. A 2014 New York Times investigation found Pruitt had a close alliance with industry lobbyists, including one who represented the backers of the Pebble Project. The EPA became the hero of tribes in the Bristol Bay region when it intervened to block Pebble. In Alaska, the EPA also polices oil spills on the North Slope, writes the National Rules for Wetland Protection, and governs the handling of hazardous materials. A controversy has erupted in Anchorage with accusations about fake news, liberal media bias, and a militant Islamic training camp in Wasilla that does not exist. As Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports, the issue started online, but within days has spread into city government.
The Anchorage Assembly's Tuesday night meeting was unusually dramatic, as Big Lake residents Greg and Malaika Jones testified.
We're here in response to the negative propaganda that Amy Dombrowski has been spewing on her radio show and Facebook.
Jones says that last Friday, when Dombrowski posted an article on Facebook about Islamic compounds across the U.S. stockpiling weapons, including one in Alaska, it implicated him. Though the Post never mentioned him by name, the materials offered enough clues to quickly figure out Jones was the one being referenced. His wife, Malaika Jones, says the Post generated comments online that have made the family feel threatened.
And then they go on to say, is there a terrorist camp? Let's go find this terrorist camp. Let's go do away with it. Let's go for a ride. And now my children are nervous. And now my family is nervous. And now it's a possibility that I have to relocate. And that's not why I came to Alaska. And I need to know why this was done. And I need assurance that you are going to help me stay safe in Anchorage, Alaska. Thank you.
The Joneses asked for an apology, which Dombosky says she doesn't owe them, because she was simply raising the question of whether a violent group might be present in Alaska.
And I want to say I appreciate your comments. And unfortunately, there are statements made that I called you a terrorist or said that you lived on a compound. I simply didn't happen.
The couple got a very different response from Assembly Chair L.V. Gray Jackson.
I'm not apologizing for Ms. Dombosky, because that's something that if she feels she needs to do, she needs to do it on her own. But I apologize as the chair of this assembly for your inconvenience and for the fear that you are now living in.
And thank you.
And it brings tears to my eyes. It really does. I'm so sorry.
In the days leading up to this exchange, accusations have ricocheted around the small but energetic world of Anchorage politics and media. After the Friday Facebook post, the progressive website Alaska Commons posted a long article faulting Dombosky for jeopardizing the Joneses with what it called fake news.
This is the Amy Dombosky Show on the Talk of the Valley.
Dombosky addressed the charges Monday on her talk show.
So my point was, this was a failure of the Alaska media. And the failure is, when we're getting national stories like this, we want you to either validate it or disprove it.
The national media attention that Dombosky is referring to is a segment she saw on Fox Business. In it, Stuart Varney hosts a short segment on weapons stockpiling on Islamic compounds around the country.
Joining us now is the man who brought us the report. His name is Ryan Morrow, national security analyst with the Clarion Project.
The Clarion Project is a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit that describes its mission as exposing the dangers of Islamic extremism. Watchdog groups have reported Clarion's board and major donors are made up of many far-right advocates who spread damaging misinformation about Islam. The Southern Poverty Law Center describes it as an anti-Muslim group. The Center for American Islamic Relations is more blunt, calling Clarion, quote, an anti-Muslim hate group. And it's Clarion's Ryan Morrow who connects a possible training camp in Alaska with a larger organization called Muslims of America, which some claim is loosely associated with a group called Jamaat al-Fukra.
So we've accumulated thousands and thousands of documents to help law enforcement with this. And just about an hour ago, we opened up a new website called FukraFiles.com, where people can learn more and look at our declassified documents about the group.
The problem is, when you look at the Fukra files for Alaska, evidence that there's a threat is, at best, unfounded, and at worst, reckless conspiracy theories and fear-mongering. Clarion's basis for its Alaska claims is that Gregory Jones and his wife moved here in 2009. The suggestion the Joneses might be terrorists is based on the couple's membership in the Muslims of America group, which Morrow says is preparing for violent confrontations across the country.
Everything is about Al-Qaeda and ISIS. It does not appear that in most cases the FBI is sharing information on the local level.
A spokesperson for the FBI says there is no evidence of anything like an Islamic compound or extremist cell in Alaska. As a religious group, Muslims of America is unconventional, and concerns have been raised in the past about anti-Semitic and homophobic views expressed by some members, including an overseas cleric. But there are no legal cases or national security investigations substantiating violent threats made by the group. When Dombosky interviewed Jones on her show during his candidacy this fall, a caller brought up Jones's history with Muslims of America, and Dombosky says what ensued was a polite discussion. In an interview earlier this week, she said her recent remarks have been blown out of proportion.
I think it's always important to source your materials, and that's exactly what I did, especially when Alaska media refuses to even pick up the topic and either help dispel it or help validate it.
But not everyone agrees with Dombosky's interpretation of her actions. Mike Walksmith was one of the last people to address her before the assembly meeting adjourned.
While you did not call Mr. Jones a terrorist, you provided the links for people to read that ultimately led to an article that associated Mr. Jones with a terrorist organization. Whether it was or not, there is no proof.
For his part, Greg Jones says he and his family hope to stay involved in the community, participating in interfaith dialogues and helping people learn more about Islam.
You know, we're going to keep moving forward. And I think that this sort of, it's worked out sort of like a blessing in disguise because of all the support that we got. So I'm happy about that.
In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Two people are missing after a commercial fishing vessel sank near Unalaska last night, forcing crew members to abandon ship. Around 11 p.m., the U.S. Coast Guard received reports the 117-foot Exito was taking on water north of Unalaska Bay. Petty Officer Meredith Manning says Air Station Kodiak sent a rescue helicopter crew to respond, and four nearby vessels volunteered to help. One located three of the five crew members and took them on board. The helicopter crew and remaining volunteer ships are still searching the area for the two missing crew members. Manning says it's unclear why the Exito began taking on water. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the state legislature is considering an audit of the state's mental health trust.
We saw a check and balance in trying to separate those functions out, and to me, that is the underlying concern.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks has completed an investigation of a campus rape case. The university will not comment on the September 2016 case, but as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the victim is again speaking out.
Former University of Alaska Fairbanks student Jessie Wadham, who first went public with her story in October, says the university's investigation backs her claim that a male student had sex with her in the Bartlett Hall dormitory while she was incapacitated by alcohol.
And that he knew that I was not able to give consent, and he knew that, and he did it anyway.
Police also investigated the case, but the district attorney declined to prosecute. The state must prove sexual assault occurred beyond a reasonable doubt, a higher hurdle than the preponderance of the evidence standard used by the university. UAF will not confirm it, but Wadham says she was recently notified by the dean of students that the student she says raped her has limited access to campus.
She emailed me saying that he had been trespassed from all the dorms. He wasn't allowed to live on campus anymore, and he wasn't allowed on campus before 8 a.m. and after 10 p.m. So that was his punishment for raping me.
It's not clear if this is the university's final action in the case. UAF spokeswoman Marmion Grimes cautions that there can be interim measures prior to any formal discipline, and both parties have input along the way.
Both the complainant and the respondent have the opportunity to meet with the dean of students and discuss the case, discuss their thoughts. There's appeal rights for both complainant and respondent as well.
Grimes could not provide a timeline for completion of the case. Wadham says she and her twin sister both withdrew from UAF following the incident and have relocated to live with family in California. Wadham says she does plan to return to UAF despite one concern.
I have to deal with, like, seeing him.
Wadham says she's decided not to sue the university because of legal costs. UA Regent John Davies of Fairbanks, who chairs a board Title IX committee, maintains the university has followed policy-dictated procedure throughout the case.
There was an investigation, there was an adjudication, and there were consequences. And it's my belief that all of those followed both our regent policies and national Title IX policies.
UAF overhauled its Title IX program in recent years after coming under federal scrutiny for failing to properly adjudicate sexual assault cases. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
In 1956, Congress set up the Alaska Mental Health Trust to make sure the state could provide mental health care programs to its residents far into the future. Since then, the trust has had a tumultuous history, and some state leaders fear it could be in danger once more. Legislators are considering a special audit of the trust and how the trustees are investing its money. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman has the story.
William Foster stands in Bean's Cafe, sifting through a pile of ceramic ornaments he helped design, then pulls one out of his pocket. It's an image of a raven. Foster, who's homeless, says he carries it with him everywhere because it reminds him of his late mother. He's participating in the Healing Faces Project, a program that focuses on art and healing circles that's funded in part by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
It calms us down, relaxes us, gives us our mind up on a lot of stuff.
The project is just one of hundreds made possible by the trust. Programs range from job training for young people with disabilities to detox centers to criminal justice reform. There are tens of thousands of people who rely on trust funds. And now, some of the people involved in creating the public corporation think it may be at risk. Alaska statute says the Mental Health Trust Fund shall be managed by the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Philip Voland, one of the lawyers who helped create the trust, says that law is really straightforward.
That's where you put the money. It's just, that's what it says. It says all the money goes there.
But since October of 2008, that's not where the money has gone. For 8 years, members of the Board of Trustees have voted to suspend transfers of the principal to the permanent fund. And instead, they're investing it themselves. Voland says that's exactly what he and other state leaders were trying to prevent. The Mental Health Trust has a complicated history. When it was first established in 1956 by Congress, 1 million acres of land in Alaska were set aside to be used by the state's legislature to fund a comprehensive mental health care system. But by 1982, most of that land trust was whittled away, given to municipalities and individuals, and little money was being spent on mental health. So a group of people sued the state. Voland represented one of the plaintiffs.
The original rulings by the state superior court declared that the state had mismanaged and destroyed the trust effectively and would have to go about reestablishing it.
It took more than a decade for the plaintiffs and the state to agree on how to do that. Voland says the plaintiffs wanted two main things.
Sufficient funds to provide for mental health programs, but who also wanted all kinds of assurances to make sure that there would not be another dissipation of the trust in the future.
In the end, the state reconstituted the original 1 million acres with mostly new land and added $200 million to reestablish the trust. They installed a board of trustees to oversee it. The cash was invested by the Permanent Fund Corporation. The land was managed by the Trust Land Office at the Department of Natural Resources. Money generated by the investments and the land went into two different pots, some to be used for mental health programs, the rest to be added to the principal and reinvested by the permanent fund. Voland says splitting the responsibilities was intentional.
To prevent any sort of rogue action by trustees, it was just a what I would say was a prophylactic measure.
During the past 8 years, instead of sending the money to the permanent fund for management, the trustees have voted to invest it all themselves. That includes buying $39 million worth of real estate. For example, they spent $17 million on an office building in Washington State in 2014 and $9 million on property in Texas this past summer. The board is also spending $2 million to try to develop a mine at Icy Cape in southeast Alaska. Greg Jones is the new CEO of the Mental Health Trust Authority and used to run the Trust Land Office. He says the Trust Land Office is more nimble than the permanent fund and can bring in more money for the trust.
We believe that we can add to what the permanent fund does and diversify and perhaps add a little more with a very carefully managed real estate program.
Jones says the way the trust is laid out, revenues from things like mineral sales go to the principal, but rent money, that all goes towards programs that help people.
What we've done with the real estate program is create an investment that pays income, that pays millions of dollars in income, that goes straight to program.
Jones and board chair Russ Webb both say they are legally allowed to use the principal to buy land and invest it as they choose. However, they would not provide copies of written legal counsel explaining their authority, could not cite specific statutes or regulations, and would not allow their attorney to speak on the matter. Boland is not the only person concerned about the legality of the trust's investments. Bruce Botello was the attorney general back in 1994 and was sitting on the opposite side of the table from Boland, looking up for the state's interests. Botello says they purposely separated the trust's money management from their land management, in part because the permanent fund was already managing money and doing it well.
And we saw a little reason to duplicate that effort.
Botello says he's not commenting on how well the trust is managing its assets. That's not the point.
We saw a check and balance in trying to separate those functions out. And to me, that is the underlying concern.
Botello, Voland, and others want a special legislative audit of the trust authority, the land office, and the board of trustees. They say it's up to the legislature to decide if the board's actions are legal. Representative Mike Hawker is requesting the audit, and the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee will make a decision at its December 13th meeting. If lawmakers act, auditors will look into everything from the legality of the trust's financial management to potential Open Meetings Act violations. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. If you have an opinionated teenager in your home who thrives on proving a point, check out the Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future Scholarship Competition organized by UAA's Seawolf Debate Program. More than $10,000 in prizes will be awarded. Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future gives the next generation of Alaskans a voice in the direction of our state. Contest details available at debatingakfuture.com. This message sponsored by Seawolf Debate.
Responders say one person has died in a plane crash on military property in Alaska's interior. Clint Johnson, the head of the National Transportation Safety Board's Alaska Division, says the private civilian plane crashed this afternoon 17 miles southeast of Fairbanks. He says there was only one person on board the plane when it went down. Alaska State Troopers say the crash occurred at Fort Wainwright. Johnson says a military helicopter crew confirmed the fatality and wreckage. Johnson says NTSB investigators will be heading to the crash site from Anchorage probably tomorrow. The coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge ranks as one of the most controversial chunks of land in Alaska. Since Congress set it aside for more study in 1980, environmental groups, politicians, and industry have battled over whether to explore for oil there or to protect the wilderness forever. As the Trump administration gets ready to take the White House in January, the debate will likely flare up again. And even though the fights dragged on for decades, Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk reports there's still a lot we don't know about what lies beneath the refuge.
It might be the biggest secret in Alaska.
It's sort of like a murder mystery, you know, a paperback book. You can speculate about why the information is not leaked out, what was found.
That's David Hausnecht with the U.S. Geological Survey. He's talking about a single exploratory oil well from 1985, the only well ever drilled in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The companies behind it keep the results under lock and key. Even the USGS couldn't see the data in 1998 when it made the most recent estimate of the amount of oil in the refuge. Alaska's politicians have pushed to explore for oil in the coastal plain, or 1002 area, for decades. In 1980, Congress put off permanently protecting the area like the rest of the refuge because of its potentially massive oil and gas reserves. But how much oil is actually there is a big question. Here's Hausnecht again.
There is a lot of uncertainty about whether or not the resources are present and whether or not the resources are of sufficient size to be deemed technically recoverable.
USGS estimates there's somewhere between 4.3 and 11.8 billion barrels of oil in the coastal plain. Those are huge numbers. For comparison, Alaska's second biggest oil field, Kuparuk, holds about 2.5 billion barrels. So there could be an oil bonanza in the coastal plain, or not. Whether it makes economic sense to drill there depends a lot on how big the oil deposits are and how hard it is to get to those deposits. Some Alaskans say that uncertainty is an argument for exploration.
We believe there's tremendous opportunity in the 1002 area.
Andy Mack leads Alaska's Department of Natural Resources.
At a minimum, and this has always been the state's request, is that we be able to go in and look and to find out what's there.
In 2014, Alaska sued the Obama administration when it refused to let the state study the coastal plain's oil potential. Alaska's politicians are hoping a Trump administration will finally let them find out if a huge oil discovery lies beneath the refuge. But they'll face stiff opposition.
This is a place where the Wilderness Society and others will continue to draw a line in the sand.
That's Nicole Whittington-Evans of the Wilderness Society in Anchorage. Her group believes the coastal plain isn't just an important part of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, it's the most important part of the refuge. The state and the oil industry argue oil development there can be done responsibly, but Whittington-Evans says she isn't convinced.
There is no way that oil and gas development could proceed in the coastal plain of the refuge without large, far-reaching infrastructure impacts across either entire sections or the entire coastal plain itself.
The region is home to polar bears, migratory birds, and the famous porcupine caribou herd. The Gwich'in people have joined environmental groups in calling for the coastal plain to be protected permanently because they hunt the caribou. Sarah James is from Arctic Village and sits on the Gwich'in Steering Committee.
Many times people were hungry, but caribou migrate through our country. If it wasn't for the caribou, we probably wouldn't be here today.
But the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation is in favor of opening the coastal plain to oil exploration. The Native Corporation owns subsurface rights to the spot where the mysterious test well was drilled in 1985. And about that well, Housenek says the USGS wasn't allowed to look at the results, but they could access other data collected around the test well. That means the federal government has a rough idea of what the oil companies found. So I had to ask. What was USGS's interpretation of what might be there? It turns out USGS has never published that finding. So the results of that test well will remain a mystery. It will take an act of Congress to allow more oil exploration in the refuge. And Alaska's representatives in Washington have been trying to clear that hurdle for 30 years. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
We'll have more on the Arctic Refuge next week when Alaska Public Media's Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin shows us how the two sides are gearing up for the next ANWR battle in Congress. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Zachariah Hughes, Ann Hillman, and Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Laura Craigle in Unalaska, and Tim Bodoni in Galena. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future. And by
GCI, keeping Alaskans connected to live the life they choose. GCI is an Alaska-born and raised telecommunications company and a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every day. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.